I don't know if I've ever explained this, but I turn in my columns go up on the Escapist on Tuesday, but I turn them in on Fridays just to give the editors, some time to poke at it and do whatever they need to do to it.
Sure, makes sense.
And this week, I turned in my column, and 6 hours later, I immediately regretted everything I wrote.
Oh no. So hang on. We do the die cast on Saturdays usually, and it goes up on Monday. And so you're saying that your
Yes.
written piece takes 2 more extra days of turnaround time. So it's like 2 days less current even
Right.
than the die cast.
Yes. And that's not really that they need the time. It's just usually my column isn't terribly topical. Like, it's not a news column. It's just whatever I'm talking about. So, you let it sit there over the weekend. And really, it's just to give them 2 business days, but those business days happen to straddle the weekend.
Right.
So my column, spoiler for tomorrow. Well, here's the other thing. I turn in my column on Friday. It usually gets edited depending on when I turn it in on Friday, either on Friday or on Monday. It goes live on Tuesday, and then I link it on my blog on Wednesday. So if you only read my blog, there's a huge gap between when I write the words and when you read them.
So your
Anyway.
redaction of your article that's going to go up, we can get that now, and it'll go up before your article does.
I'm not redacting anything. I turned it in. It's
Okay.
done. It's still true. Everything I said in the spoiler for Wednesday or whenever you folks finally get around to reading the column, the thesis of the column is, hey, Anthem isn't that bad.
Uh-oh.
I noticed that Anthem scored 60 on Metacritic. Now, I fully admit up front that haggling over review scores is really tedious, and I'm sorry, but it was really bugging me that Anthem's score was so much lower than Mass Effect Andromeda's. Anthem is better at being a looter shooter than Andromeda is at being anything. Like, Andromeda is a story-based party based shooter where the story's terrible, your party is boring, and the shooting is serviceable, right? So it was bothering me that Anthem was scoring so much lower, and people were just savaging Anthem, which I think is just a middle of the road game, and I actually think Andromeda is actually a deeply flawed game. So this bothered me. So to push back against the hate train a bit, I wrote an entire article of all the good things that I thought about Anthem. You
Well,
know,
that's very fair
here,
of you.
yeah. And wrote it, turned it in, and then that was Friday. Knock off for the day. Evening rolls around, time to play video games. I fire up Anthem, wait through all the loading screens, get through the login and everything, and I'm sitting there in front of my Javelin, and I realize I don't care anymore. I don't want to play this game.
No.
I'd already paid the admission price of, like, 2 minutes of loading screens and splash screens and waiting and everything. I was ready to go. I could hop in my Javelin, and after another 30 seconds of loading screens, I could be playing the game. And I was like, no, I don't care anymore.
Oh,
And so that
man.
was disappointing. Yeah, it was really sudden. Like, I'd had a good time the previous day, and I was enjoying it, but it reminds me of Guild Wars 2, where I was just engrossed with it for like a month and a half. And then at the same time, everybody sort of decided, wow, I never want to log in again. So that's where I'm stuck with Anthem.
You had just spent all this time saying, hey, it's not so bad, and then you got back home and like there's food all over the floor and you're just like, I'm not putting up with this anymore.
Oh, it's such a shame about Anthem. The one thing I will say in Anthem's defense is everything that's wrong with it can be fixed. Like, you couldn't fix Andromeda with post-release patches.
Wow, that's low praise.
Well, you know, you couldn't fix Andromeda. It's like, oh yeah, our first patch is going to give it a completely different story and premise and main villain. Like, you can't patch things like that. Those are things you're stuck with. But Anthem has a good foundation. It's just the details need, you know, it needs more content. And the content needs a little more spice.
And maybe some better user interface so you can see what's actually happening. And a little better tutorial or something.
Yeah. Even in my column, I made this point. I thought this was an interesting observation. I'll just spoil my entire column. Right? When you're playing... When you're playing Destiny, you know, it's the same deal. You run around and you shoot dudes, right?
Yeah.
And in Destiny, it is by Bungie, and Bungie really knows their gameplay. When you kill an enemy in Destiny 2, when you kill him with a headshot, his helmet basically explodes, right? There's this shower of red sparks and maybe a little bit of flame that's right away, a real sudden flash of particles. Then, just like a quarter or a half second later, there's a jet of blue vapor that comes out of the suit straight up. As if, you know, now that you've blown his helmet apart, his whole suit is decompressing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
This two-action thing happens. You get three sounds. There's the sound of the explosion, the sound of him grunting or yelling as he dies, and there's the sound of that decompression. Again, timed slightly off so that you get these double punch effect.
Yeah, and it's all across the spectrum, too. The explosion is a deep bass, the yell is right in the middle, and then the hiss is all high notes. So it's like
a good full spectrum
experience.
That's a good point. That's exactly how it is. And your cursor changes for a moment from your normal cursor, and it turns into a little red X. And I know that sounds like a tiny thing, but that's really satisfying when you see that flash for just a second, that red X appears, and you know you just nailed someone with a headshot.
Yeah.
The damage
because that's where you're looking. Your eyes are locked right on that point because you're focusing.
Right, it doesn't say headshot down in the corner or anything. It's right there at the thing where your eyes already are. On top of all that, they use a slightly different animation, like the body sort of jolts, and then it topples over, like you've just sort of decapitated it, and it has this almost cartoonish reaction to it, where like the whole body goes, I don't know if I want to say rigid, but sort of flails for a second and then falls over, which is different. If you just shoot somebody until they run out of hit points, they flop forward, right? So you get a different animation. So basically this one action, this one thing of shooting a guy in the head to kill him generates three different sounds, two sets of particle effects, two different kinds of interface feedback, and a new animation from that one action.
Yeah, I was really hoping you were going to say a partridge in a pear tree. It's just, sorry.
But that's a lot of feedback. And that's the way the game is. It's very rich in feedback. And this is something a lot of games just... Oh, look, I shot that guy and he fell down. Okay, that's good. We should put that in our game. And they miss the fine details. And everybody wonders, why is this game so visceral and so satisfying? And this game feels kind of bland.
Right. I think you linked a video at some point where some guys were talking about adding juice to a game. I don't know if it was you or somewhere else, but...
I was watching that several times.
Yeah. And, like, I was watching that. I'm like, yeah, there's something to that. But, like, you can't just spray juice everywhere. You've got to have it, like, in the right place. And I think that's what you're talking about here is, like, it's juicy in the right place at the right time.
Right. It should be juicy when you do a good thing. It's part of the, it's part of that stimulating the reward center of your brain. In Diablo, when the legendary, I forget what it's called, whatever, the super valuable item drops, there's a sound and a particle effect and a sort of this ray of light as if it's, you know, a ray of sunlight reaches down into the dungeon and shines on this object, right?
Right.
And that's silly, but it feels really good. You're like, oh, that's dopamine being released into my brain. That feels so good. I love it.
Yeah.
And those things, and then, you know, another game developer comes along, sees that happen, and is like, oh, well, we better have our loot be yellow and have it, you know, pop out of a monster when it drops. And they miss out on all the juice. Bungie's really good at their, at adding juice to a game. Anthem isn't bad. It's got a few moments. You can put, like, as a Colossus, you can put your shield out in front of yourself and start sprinting. And Colossus is a big stompy robot, right? And it's right. really fun. You kind of go bowling through. If there's a bunch of enemies clustered together, you stick your shield out in front of you and just sprint at them, and you're bowling. And you get a nice sound effect, little particle effect, and you get a sound of hitting them, and you get a reaction sound out of them. It's pretty good. It's not Bungie good, but it's pretty good. And I was like, you know, Anthem does pretty good in this department. But then the more I thought about it, I was like, okay, this is good for a shooter, but a looter shooter needs way more. It's one thing if there's a 5-hour campaign. It's another thing if you're supposed to play this game for 6 months.
Yeah.
And Anthem doesn't have it. Like, I'll bet even the people that are still into Anthem will burn out pretty quickly. Maybe a few, you know, some will hang on, but I'll bet the burnout rate on Anthem's going to be kind of high. Not just because it's low on content, even, yeah, go ahead.
Well, but you also aren't really, I mean, looter shooters aren't really your thing, right? You kind of gave up on Warframe too, right? And that's kind of a looter shooter.
It is. I'm still noodling around with Warframe because there are so many things to do. It's not like you just do. This is another problem with Anthem, is they have three, at the end game, they have three different dungeons you can do. They're called strongholds, right? You jump into a party of four and you blast your way through the enemy fortress and you get loot drops, right? There's literal treasure chests that spew out rare guns at little checkpoints along the way.
Okay.
But you get about the same loot, or maybe exactly, they use the same drop table, same amount of loot, except, you know, there's the easy one, and then there's the one that takes a little bit longer, and then there's the really hard one. But they all give about the, you have the same opportunity. Or if the harder one gives you better loot, it's not nearly remotely worth the extra long time it takes. It's like double the time to get through it.
Wow.
And so nobody's going to play these second two. So it's already low on content, right? We just got three strongholds to choose from. But really, you've only got the one, or most people are just doing the one because that's the fastest way to get rewards. So now right. you have the player being divided, like, do I want to do what's interesting and do something new for a change, or do I want to do what's going to get me my rewards the most efficiently? In a well-designed game, those two things would always line up.
Yeah, or there would be different rewards for different tasks. I mean,
right.
This has been the way for a long, long time. You get different mob bosses, and they've got different loot tables.
Right. They could be, the two things could be completely independent, or they could be, you know, synergize and encourage you to do these other things. But in Anthem, they're directly opposed. So that's burning people out even faster, is they're getting sick of doing, you know, the one best, the most efficient dungeon. And you're like, well,
right.
I could perform
the optimal strategy over and over again. Well, that's okay.
Yeah. Warframe has a lot of stuff to do. I said last week that I was stuck on a particular, oh, I can't get to the next planet because you have to do a perfect spy mission. And I did that whole rant about spy missions. I had Isaac just come down and beat it for me because he likes spy missions, and he's got them all. I think this is the first time we've ever. It's definitely the first time we've ever done that. That's probably common for like some parents to like, oh, I needed my kid to help with something, but like I've never had to do that, or I've never wanted to do that. But I did that here, and I was cool with it because it let me keep playing the game.
Well, there you go, family experience.
I actually have a question. I have had every time I criticize Warframe fans jump in the comments. You don't know what you're doing. You're probably doing it all wrong, and you're not doing this, or you're not doing this. And I'm like, I am doing all those things. I don't know what I'm doing wrong either. So I'm going to actually post my build. I'll post a screenshot or something of it. Here's the situation I found myself in. Isaac beat that mission for me, whatever it was. And I was free to move on to the next planet. But to do that, you have to beat, like, this boss. Now, I'm as strong as I know how to get. I don't know of any way to give myself more hit points or armor. And I'll post, like, a screenshot or whatever of my build. So, you go down into this thing where you're going to meet this boss. And he's another Tenno like you. He's another Warframe suit like you, is what I think he's supposed to be. And I hit the button. There's a shield between the two of you. I hit the button. And before my character gets out her weapon, falls over dead. Instant. Just dead. Headshotted me from across the room.
Wow.
So try again. Luckily, there was a low retry threshold. You just appear back there. Everything's reset. And I don't think it penalizes you for dying. So it's not a big deal. So I walk up and I'm like, okay, well, you can block shots with your melee weapon. Okay. So I'll get out my melee weapon and block. And before I could switch to my melee weapon, you know, open up the thing, boom, dead before I can get my melee weapon out. So I try again, third time, get out my melee weapon, hit the guard button. And this time he two-shots me to death.
Wow.
And I'm like, this is ridiculous. Am I, like, there's no guidance on what I could possibly be doing. And I type in every possible combination of junction bosses and what could I be doing wrong, and type in the name of this junction boss. And apparently I'm the only person in the world that's, you know, and it's not like the game's been signaling that I'm weak. The rest of the levels are about right. You know, guys hit kind of hard, but not too hard. I get through the levels. And then I run into this guy that headshots me from across the room. I did beat him by immediately just jumping around like crazy and waiting for him to miss enough that I could close the distance and begin pounding on him. Oh, I tried shooting him and he just, no, I'm not going to take damage from your gun. Like, it just like emptied my most powerful gun into him and it just chipped 5% off his health bar. And then I peeked around the corner a little too far and he caught me with one shot and I died. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. So then, you know, I did this dance across the room, hit him once with my melee weapon, and that instantly stun locks him. And then I'm able to beat him to death. And absolutely, it's absolutely trivial once I reach him. And I'm like, this game is so weird. Maybe that's the intended experience. Maybe the game developer thought this was fun. Or thought like, well, this.
My intuition is that this is the behavior that they're training you to do in the spy missions is the same kind of behavior that you should have done in that mission. I don't know anything about Warframe, but like some sort of like avoidance and dodging around kind of thing that would serve you well to, you know, beat the spy mission. And then they're like, well, here's the boss and you can show off how good you are at this thing that you just, you know, perfected.
No, because just as soon as you open the shield, there is no, you can't sneak up on him. He's literally looking at you, and you're right in front of him, and there's nowhere to hide. You're, by definition, if you're in the spot to press this button, then he instantly sees you and headshots you, unless you leap right away and begin bouncing around the room like crazy, and you do a couple of They're called bullet jumps. Bullet jump across the room towards him. And then just stun lock him. And I'm like, that wasn't even an intro. That was really dumb and frustrating, getting insta-killed. And then it was dumb and sort of a letdown when I just, you know, just mash the melee button over and over until he's dead. And I'm like, is this the intended experience or what? What is it with this weird-ass game? I don't know.
I'd be interested to hear what the people say in the comments about that, because that sounds crazy.
Yeah. So normally I would assume, oh, this game is signaling to me that I'm not high enough level and I'm supposed to go do side content. But Warframe's presentation of, like, levels is so weird and obtuse, and I have no idea. When you don't know, when you hit something really hard, am I just not powerful enough, or is this what it's supposed to be like? Or if something's really easy, am I supposed to go look for harder content? Or am I just supposed to, like, slaughter waves and waves of these mooks? I found that was the best way to level up weapons, is to just go on a survival level and, you know, an easy survival level that just lets you kill just roomfuls of guys. And I'm like,
it's
normally
just a spawner
in a game
there, and you just stand in front of the spawner and churn them up.
Well, they spawn behind any closed door. So you just get in a room with lots of doorways all around, and they just keep pouring in. And normally a game would give you zero XP. Oh, these guys are too easy. You don't get a reward for fighting them. But this game's happy to, like, give you lots of XP for killing lots of dudes. So it's, I mean, I like that. I like that. It's fun. But yeah, it is sort of like, it sort of confuses, like, I have no idea what the intended experience is here. And I'm just sort of mystified by the whole thing. So I will post my build and other people can look at it and go, you have 1/10 the hit points you're supposed to have. You need to go and grind for this other thing or equip one of these things. Or maybe they'll tell me, no, you're just, that's fine. You're doing everything right. That's what you're supposed to do. I guess we'll
everyone
find
gets one shotted by that guy.
Yeah. Let's do a mailbag.
All right.
Dear Diecast, with rumors of the Xbox Game Pass coming to the Nintendo Switch, I haven't heard this rumor yet, so that's interesting. Should Sony consider re-entering the handheld market? Is it worth the risk for Sony to build a successor to the PS Vita or consider making the PS5 a hybrid console? Would it be better for them to leave the market to Nintendo and Microsoft? Regards, Eric.
So there's like two questions in there. One is, do you know anything about consoles? Spoilers, neither of us know anything about consoles, apparently. Because I haven't heard of that either. That's really interesting. So Xbox, that's their, like, free subscription, or not free, but, like, subscription service where you'd subscribe and then you get, like, whatever games are on the service that month or something?
I believe so. It's certainly, Game Pass certainly sounds like it. But coming to the Switch, do they even have that many games on the Switch? That's funny.
Or is it, like, they're gonna have, they've got some sort of thing that runs Xbox games on the Switch, maybe?
I don't know. Is it worth the risk for Sony to build a successor to the PS Vita? See, that sounds like a bad deal all around, because the PS Vita was just a joke for its whole lifespan. Everyone who's like, ha ha, you bought a Vita.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite the hilarious failure of, like, the N-Gage, but it was definitely not a successful handheld.
It was one of the losers.
Yeah. So, I can't see what they would get out of it. I can't even see what anybody would get out of building a handheld today. Like,
just at all? I mean, the Switch seems like it's working really well.
Right, but the Switch has the advantage of being hybrid. So you can take your game with you, but it's a console experience that you take with you. And you've even got the controllers with you and everything. But, like, a handheld dedicated to gaming. To repeat the meme, do you guys not have cell phones? I mean, like, doesn't everybody just play games on their cell phones these days?
Yeah, well, it would be nice Oh, maybe that's something Sony could do. Like, it would be nice if there was some kind of portable operating system that you could run your games on your phone. Like, no matter what phone you had, it's just like, well, this app or whatever will run this whole family of games, and then have some sort of controller, because phones don't have tactile feedback, and so, like,
right.
Some sort of thing that snapped onto your phone, and it was, like, configurable or whatever, so that you could snap it onto any phone. I don't know.
That would work, but that would be kind of weird. I don't know if they'd want to get into that business. But, yeah, I would want something like that, where you could have a controller that sort of fit around your phone and made it feel like a DualShock or approximated a DualShock. I play games on my phone, but I don't play, you know, real games. I've got Time Wasters for when you're sitting in the waiting room or stuck at a bus stop, or I don't ride buses, but just, you know, in those situations where you have to kill 10 minutes.
Yeah. And then if it was integrated with the whatever app was on your phone, then you could have it also act like a dock, so that you could set it next to a dock and then it would broadcast to your screen or something. I don't know. It seems like there's a market for that somewhere. It basically like a Switch, only you don't have to buy the Switch. You just have your phone and it's like, you know, $100 instead of $400.
I don't know if you can do this through the USB connection. I'll bet you can't. But if there was just some way that you could just use the screen, that would probably be enough to cut down the price. Because that's a big part of the price of these things, is the screen. So you've got your little gaming thing, and it's got its own processor, its own hardware, you know, its own operating system and everything, and it's got its own card or whatever.
Yeah.
For games, but you use your phone screen. So if you've got a great big screen on your phone, then you have a great big screen on your game. And that would let you leave the screen off the gaming, whatever you call this thing, peripheral platform. That might be a little weird and confusing for people because it's not really running on your cell phone. But yeah, that might work. Although I don't know that Sony would want to get into that business.
Well, Sony does hardware, right? And they got into gaming just so they could sell more hardware.
Yeah.
So, like, you can't compete with cell phones. The quantities are so huge that you're never going to beat them on volume.
Right. Cell phones are so huge and so cheap. I mean, my phone, I'm holding it in my hand. It's 4 years old. It's got, you know, a screen that's as good as my eyeballs can use. It's absolutely perfect, and I think it was $50, like 4 years ago. And I've never looked at this phone and thought, I should upgrade this. Like, there is nothing that I've ever wanted to do that this phone couldn't do. And it's 4 years old. Like, they are just so cheap and so powerful. Like, how would you go in and compete in the... And there are just a sea of games out there. So it seems like a tough place to compete is the handheld market.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, it seems like if you can't compete in, like, the screen, the processor, and the battery, then all that's left is the interface. Like, you've just got to design the best interface possible for a mobile system and then, like, just slave it into the computer that you've got in your phone already.
Yeah.
It's probably a low margin market, but it's the only one they have left. If they want to get into mobile gaming, it's like that's all you've got.
If they can't do that, then I would say just leave the handheld gaming market to Nintendo. I wouldn't go out of my way to compete with them after having lost so badly to them the last time around, especially since Sony is always sort of peacocking around talking about how powerful their hardware is. So you'd have to have a really powerful handheld, and that's a really terrible place to compete.
Yeah, it would be, well, especially since they also like having their own proprietary whatever, and like the most powerful and cheapest hardware that you can get is just like, we'll just buy it off the shelf from a cell phone manufacturer.
Exactly. Exactly. So wanting to do their own thing with their own hardware and it's all proprietary would just make it ridiculously expensive. You'd have something that isn't as useful as a cell phone that costs twice as much. And that's just, and, you know, are there any games for it after the PS Vita? Boy, that, okay. What a stupid name. Why was it called the PS Vita? That is an annoying name. It is not cool. Oh, I've got a Vita.
Does that not roll like off the tongue.
No, and it sounds like a health drink.
Yeah, your Vita mix. It's like a blender, right. Maybe.
Right, yeah, the Vita, maybe it's for making smoothie, or maybe it's like this brand of carrot juice that you can buy. This, you know, fair trade organic carrot juice called PS Vita.
Vita 2, coming from Sony, this year, competing with Soylent.
So, yeah, after that failure, nobody's going to want to make games for this thing. So what, are you going to make it able to run PS4 games? Good luck with that.
No, so you just got to make it compatible with the Android operating system. And then just... And actually, it's just a phone.
Just Sony already makes phones, this don't video they? Game thing. What?
Doesn't Sony already make phones?
Do they?
Or maybe not.
I don't know. I've never owned... I don't even know what brand of phone I own. I just, you know, it runs Android. That's all I know.
Yeah. Yeah, if they could make a really good... They just made it make, like, Unity, but for Android. Does Unity run on Android?
Yes. Yes. Oh.
Sony should just buy Unity. No, actually, that would be terrible for everyone.
Yeah, that really would be. They would not be good to Unity. Yeah, Unity is really amazing. When you go to, like, hey, I'm done making this project. I want to export it to a standalone executable. You just hit this thing and it brings up a dialogue. All right, where do you want to put it? You want Linux? You want it on Mac? You want it on PC? You want it on Android? I think Android. Okay, it's been 6 months since I looked at that dialogue, but I'm sure there's some sort of mobile option there, and it's not an exotic weird one. Maybe it's macOS. I can't remember, or not Mac, whatever the iPhone operating system is. It's iOS, either it's one of those. Yeah, it's either iOS or Android. So that's really good. Like the idea that you could release a game for Xbox and PC. And Mac and phones, like, and do this super cross-platform thing as an indie. That's normally really hard. You need to, like, hire specialists to do that. Like, okay, we finished the game. Now we need to find somebody that knows Mac.
See, if they could just make a really good controller that emulates the freedom of the mouse and keyboard, and then they'd just be making a Steam controller.
That's it. Buy that. Go to Valve and say, you guys, I know you still have a warehouse full of Steam controllers left over. Let us take those off your hand and we'll glue a smartphone screen to it.
It's perfect. Call us, Sony.
All right. Let's do another. Actually. Since we're sort of talking about programming, you mentioned you were doing some programming.
Yeah, I started off doing programming to do plugins to Blender. So, like, Blender runs Python, so I learned Python so that I could write, like, stuff for Blender. And originally, it was just to write this one thing I had in mind. I wanted to make castles, like stone for stone, a castle in Blender. And it's like, well, it's going to take forever if I do it by hand. But I could write a computer program to make the stones, and then the computer program could build the castle. So I was like, all right, I'm gonna do this.
All right, that sounds cool.
So that was, like, back in 2007, I think. Still haven't actually made the castle generator, but I did make the wall thing. And along the way, I was like, oh, well, this is really powerful. And, you know, there's a bunch of other plugins I could make for Blender. And, like, so I made a few scripts that did stuff in Blender. And then I got into doing stuff in Minecraft. And that's how I got into the Minecraft thing. And Then I was doing a little bit of mod support in KSP. That was Andy was doing all the programming, but I was kind of helping out. And so, like, I've been dabbling around in Python stuff for a while. And I got this idea. Oh, man, where was it? I stumbled on this idea of doing arbitrary convex solids. I think it was crystals or something. I don't know. I was deep in this mind space of, like, making the ultimate perfect game. And so I was like, all right, well, I need to be able to generate, like, the ultimate perfect geometry to get the ultimate perfect game. And I was looking at crystals and things. I was like, this is really cool. And it's amazing how all the planes are all, you know, it's not triangles. Like, when you look at a crystal, it's not a bunch of triangles joined together at vertices. It's a bunch of planes that are intersecting each other. And then the vertices just happen to be wherever the planes intersect.
Yeah.
So it makes this really clean look. I don't know. It looks beautiful because, I don't know, we look at crystals and we're like, that's a beautiful thing. And so something about it, it's a very beautiful shape. So I was like, all right, I'm going to write a script to make that. And that was like, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago, started working on this thing and still haven't finished that either.
I've seen some of the models that it outputted, though. You have those on your website. Those are cool looking.
Thanks. Yeah.
What's not done about it?
Okay, so it works great if you've got a bunch of planes and you just want to have them in arbitrary positions and stuff, and like you run it and it does a bunch of, I don't know, I could describe it, but it's like just a bunch of math, vector math, basically.
Sure.
So that it can, you know, it traces around each face, and I'm sure that there's like a better way to do this somehow. With reflections Verneuil volumes, I think, in 3D.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I don't know how to pronounce that word, but I know what you mean. Yeah, I've done the 2D version of those diagrams, and I immediately began thinking it's Voronoi or something like that. The 3D version of that sounded like what you were doing. So that's cool.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. Only I'm trying to do it just for one thing instead of like a whole bunch of objects. And it turns out that if you just reflect the centers around the face volumes, then you can do it for one instead of multiple. Anyway, so I've got this technique where it's tracing around the faces, and it works fine, except if you have multiple faces that are coincident exactly. So normally you have three faces and they all meet at one corner, but if you have like four or five or six faces that all meet at one corner, then the program has to choose which face is the correct one that will make the smallest volume. And for whatever reason, like, my code just won't do that.
That's a hard problem.
Well, it seems like it would be an easy problem, right? Because you just look at the thing and it's like, well, whatever makes the smallest volume, right? I mean, that should be easy. But it's for the computer, it's like, well, what does that mean?
Right, visually you could do it, but now you've got to like, okay, well, what's the volume of all the possibilities?
Yeah.
I got to try all possible combinations, get the volume of all of them. Some of them might not have a volume if it doesn't make an enclosed solid for whatever reason. So you got to check for that. And then you have to keep track of, okay, well, this one was the smallest volume. Yeah, that's not a trivial thing to solve. That's a pretty ambitious thing to do for your second programming project in a language.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not my second. I did a bunch of other stuff, but it's, yeah. So I'm working on fixing that problem. And, I started working on it, and I was like, all right, I'm going to nail this down. I put a bunch of debug code in there, so it spits out a bunch of numbers, and start working my way through, and I'm like, oh, well, this is a weird thing. Like, I shouldn't be doing it this way. I should be, this is backward, like, or I should be normalizing this vector. And so I started fixing bugs, and it's like, I thought that there was just this one bug, and then once I fixed it, that would, you know, it would work perfectly. But, like, I found a bug, and I fixed it, and it works differently, but it's still not right.
Yeah. It's like trying to kill off roaches. It's like, no, I fixed all the no, there's another one. Well, this is definitely the last one, and you squash it, and then, wait, there's one more. And, you know, a week and a half later, you're like, okay, this has definitely got to be the last one for sure. I can't imagine. What? There's still bugs. What?
Yeah. Yeah. So like I've been killing off bugs for like 3 or 4 days now, and just like fix a bug. Okay, good. Run it again. All right. Well, maybe it solves it in that particular test case, but then I'll make a new test case and it breaks in that one. It's like, all right, well, what's wrong now? And it's just bug after bug after bug. And like, obviously this indicates that I'm not a very good programmer. I wouldn't have put all these bugs in, but it's also just like, this thing is so complicated. And for such something that looks so simple on the surface, that makes an object that looks so simple on its surface, which is the whole point. Like, it's so right? difficult to get all the bugs ironed out.
Yeah. But that's a lot of programming projects. You envision something that seems like it should be simple. Oh, two streets forming an intersection. That's simple. That's simple. Your human brain can immediately grasp all the elements of that. But when you turn it into code, you can't just tell the computer, yeah, if they're at an angle, kind of round it off and make sort of a triangular intersection. You have to like, oh, how do I abstract the idea of an intersection into mathematics? How do I take this thing that I can picture in my brain and turn it into mathematics? And it's one of those things sometimes you won't realize how hard it is until you sit down at the computer and your hands are hovering over the keyboard and you realize, wait a minute.
Yeah. And then you do a lot of things where you're like, I'm not sure if this is right. And so I'll just try it and get something. Because at first you're just trying to get anything that works at all.
Right.
And so then by the time you get all the way there, it's like, well, how many compromises did I make on my way to getting just anything? And it's like, well, all of it. Every line of code is a compromise to getting toward just anything. And so then it's like, well, where's the bug? Well, it's everything I wrote is a bug. Like the whole thing is just this one giant compromise trying to get something that'll work. And it's like, well, it does kind of work. And like, I should be happy. And I am pretty happy with it. But like, how do I get it so it's perfect? Well, you basically have to tear the whole thing up. But you can't just throw it all away. You have to tear it up line by line and find each problem individually. It's just exhausting.
That's the job. Yep. Just to make you feel better, it gets way easier in the future. Don't worry. It's going to be way, way easier if you just keep at it. And someday, you'll be able to write magic code and it'll all just happen. I'm lying
well,
to you.
I've actually had that experience where, like, I was writing something and I wrote a number of scripts for Minecraft that would change a Minecraft world so they would alter something. And this was while I had a day job. And so I would be, like, at my day job and I'd be kind of lightly browsing the Minecraft forums. I mean, not really reading them, but just, you know, I was working. But occasionally I would read something in the
right.
Minecraft forums. And sometimes people would post bugs and you'd be like, hey, this thing happens, it's all weird. And I would look at it and be like, oh, I know what does that. I'll bet I could fix it. And so I would go into my code without ever testing it because I'm at work. And I would go into my code, make the change, commit it, and then be like, here's the new code. I think it's fixed. And they'd be like, yay, it's fixed.
Oh.
And I'd be like, yes, I am a programming god. It's so good. But that's like, you know, one tiny change at a time, right? And it's like, oh, well, you know, yeah, you fixed one tiny bug, but yeah. So it does get easier sometimes if you've got a really good code base, I suppose, and you're really familiar with it, and what you're doing is actually really simple, and it's built on top of someone else's fairly well-developed code base.
I had a story. I had a problem like that. I saw a bug report. This is back when I worked at Active Worlds. I was the new junior programmer on the team. This would have been 2001 or so. And I'd just been entrusted with the code base, and I saw a bug report, and I knew it was with, you know, this is from a user. It was with code that I had recently written. And I immediately I know what did that. Just fix it. Check it in. I forget why. I was in a hurry or whatever, because I was working on something else. But, I'll set aside this main thing I'm working on. Real quick, just fix that bug. Check it in. And then it turns out my check, I did not test it. I just checked it in, which you should never, ever, ever do. But I was dumb, and I just checked it in, and it made the program crash on startup.
Oh, no!
So, I got a phone call from Roland, my boss. Roland was so cool. He was such a good bot. Roland was such a good boss. And he just sort of like, you know, he knew that I knew that I'd messed up. And so, he just called me, told me what I did. He realized that my humiliation was already an appropriate punishment, and he didn't need to, like, use harsh words or call me stupid or anything. Just like, yeah, don't do that. And from that day on, I never checked anything in without testing it 10 different ways.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you really should. Don't do what I did or Seamus did. Like, you really should test your code, but it feels really good when you don't, and it still works.
Right. And you think it's just a one line change. It's just one line. It's such a trivial thing. Why would I need to test this? That's silly. But yeah, test it, because you're probably forgetting something. There's a million lines of code in this code base. There's probably some part of it that is not in your head right now.
Right.
To test it.
Yeah, well, and that's the other thing. I was working with, like, this tiny little, it was like maybe 10,000 lines or less of code at a time. So it was like such a tiny code base. You really could kind of understand the whole flow of the thing all in your head at once. That's the weird thing about this crystal thing, though, is like it's also a very short piece of code. Like, it's not a lot of code. It's got like one bit. It's got a few functions for doing vector math. It's got one bit that starts off the process. It's got one bit that like checks the distance. And then it's got one thing that like ties all the faces together. And that's it. Like, it's very compact. And like, you don't want it to be big and complicated, because what it's doing is not complicated. It's just also wrong. Like, the way I'm doing it is somehow wrong. It's like, no, what does this mean?
So does Blender offer any functionality to Python? Can you just say, yeah, here's 4 points, make a face, and it handles all the details?
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
That's really nice. That's super fun.
Yeah, it's really super fun. Nice to develop in the 3D space of Blender, because it's got all the tools, and you can look at it and you can spin it around. It's got all the interface and stuff to do stuff with. And then all of that is exposed to Python. So if you want to do something that you normally do with a bunch of mouse clicks, you can just tell it to do it in Python. And you know, it interfaces nicely with Python. So, yeah,
you don't even have to wait to, like, start your, I'll compile my program and then run it and then see what the result is. It's just right there. What do you just hit a button and it just makes you a thing?
You can even have it auto-run the code so that it just runs it every time you type anything into the console, and it just like runs your whole thing every time.
That's so cool. That is a really fun way to work. Really frictionless.
The most fun I've had in Blender with programming Python is where you right-click on any interface element and say edit source, and it takes you to the Python code that defines that interface so that you can just like edit the user interface in Python live.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. Except when I can't figure out what I'm doing.
Let's do another mailbag question.
All right.
Hi. I got an itch to replay old and very niche games, Brigade E5 and 7.62mm. I've never heard of either of those, since there were nothing like them to this day. Nothing even close. They're very simulationist, hardcore tactical strategies, like XCOM and Jagged Alliance 2, but with real time, with smart pause. Huh. Okay. Skipping down to so long paragraph here, I'm going to skip. So my question is there a merit in going against getting fun, balanced, or polished gameplay and going for complete one-to-one realism? Like, you know, even going beyond what Arma and SWAT 4 have done. What would be gained from this in your eyes, and what would be lost? Best regards, Deadly Dark. I don't know. I'm kind of weak in this area because I'm not real big on super hardcore simulation.
You like
In
Kerbal
fact,
Space Program, though, right?
that's true. That's very true. Often I enjoy the abstractions, like a real how much stuff can I carry game would keep track of, like, okay, this object fits in this pocket, and this object can be slung across your back, and this object you have to hold in this hand, and this object in this hand, and this object you can drape over your shoulders or around your neck. Like, you could do that for inventory, and it's like, oh, there would be no argument from the player why you can only carry a few things. It's obvious why I can't carry more things. My hands are full, and my pockets are
Right.
full. But I enjoy the abstraction of an inventory grid.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, I enjoy that much better than, having to figure out what pocket to put everything in. And so I'm probably a bad person to ask about super hardcore simulation. Another simulationist game, it's a different sort of simulationist, but Dwarf Fortress leans pretty hard into simulation.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And it's so deep in some areas, but then the portrayal of it is so elementary and so abstracted.
Right.
I don't know. It's not like a fully simulationist game. It's like it's only in one aspect or another, I suppose. 'Cause like in the ones that he's talking about, if it's like Arma or something, you've got all these characters and running around, they've got guns and bullets and stuff. And like it's a really deep simulation, it's about the guns and bullets and things, but like really in a real war, the hardest thing is keeping your troops' morale up and keeping them alert while they're out in the field doing nothing. So like if you're really gonna have a simulationist
Right.
war game, you should have a game where you just sit around and do nothing for hours and hours and hours, and then someone pops up and tries to kill you, and like you have to be alert the whole time. So like
Right.
that doesn't sound fun.
Right. Yeah. Especially everybody has to get enough sleep. Everybody has
Yeah.
to.
You
Ugh.
manage your food, and your cook is like, how much food are you going to spend on each of these guys? And are you going to prepare the good food now? Or are you going to wait till later when you're going through the bog?
Yeah, morale, super important. And morale's a tough one, is a tough one in a video game. Just it's one of those things that kind of gets on your nerves. It's like when the morale goes down and it dooms the party. Oh, everybody's morale is down, now they're doing half the work. And it's like you would survive if you just like worked at your full capacity, but you're moping and it's gonna kill you.
Right.
And in a real war simulation, in a real situation, you can understand why this is and what's going on and how people aren't thinking clearly. But when your characters are all little abstractions and you can fiddle with their numbers and their inventory and everything, then you kind of want to just treat them like chess pieces. And it's like trying to move your knight in chess and it doesn't wanna. It's like this is
Yeah.
just irritating.
Right. Yeah, so a game, it seems like, is in some way you need to have it not be completely simulationist, or it's like, well, why don't I just do this in real life?
Why don't I just go and participate in a war in real life?
Yeah, just join the army. But on the other hand, it seems like the simulation aspects are valuable. Like whenever I've seen a game simulating something, I felt like, okay, well, I can engage with this at least, right? Like if it doesn't simulate it and it abstracts it away, then it's on the game to deal with it properly. But if it presents it to me as a mechanic, then it's on me to deal with it properly. And it's like, okay, well, at least you're giving me the
Yeah.
option to do it well.
Flight simulators are another very simulationist thing.
Yeah.
Very like, well, what's the game? Well, you just fly from this commercial airport to this commercial airport in this common plane. It's like, where's the game? People do that all the time. That's not a game. It's like, yeah, that's the game. Heck, Euro Truck Simulator is a game about driving a big rig, and that's it.
Right.
So, yeah, there is room for simulationist games, but I don't know. It's a hard sell for sure. Like, what is it, like, to answer his question, what would be lost? Well, probably your money as a developer. Like, this is a risky thing to do. I mean, there are not a lot of hardcore simulations out there. And even the ones that do exist don't sell really well. You know what? I think super hardcore simulationist combined with really unforgiving is not really rewarding in a game to most people. Like that, I've played one of those, I forget what it was. It's not Arma, but it's one of those simulators. I mean, this is way back early 2000s. Was it Operation Flashpoint, maybe? Maybe that was it. And I remember there
that
was
does sound
a
like the
mission.
Title of the game.
What?
That does sound like the title of a game. I don't know if it's the one you're thinking of.
Yeah. There was a mission that was like, just stand guard duty. And I think the mission was only 10 minutes, and after 10 minutes, the enemy attacks. But in a video game, 10 minutes is a really long time, and you just get bored. And then you stop paying attention, and you just start wandering around and hopping on all the stuff, you know. And you're like, I don't know, is there anything to do in this game? Can I get up? And then all of a sudden, the bad guys show up and kill you, and you realize, oh, now I've got to wait around for another 10 minutes. Like, some people are into that. And they, you know, that's exciting to them. But that's a hard sell to the masses. On the other hand, something like Euro Truck Simulator is more, the simulation is kind of relaxing. It's not, the game is not actively trying to destroy you or ruin your truck. It's just something for you to do.
Yeah. Another thing I think that the guard duty example fails to touch on is that games can allow you to skip time. Like Deadly Dark was talking about, it's got this real-time plus pause thing, and it would be really cool if you could just say, like, all right, we'll just go until the enemy shows up and then pause it for me, right? And then you go make a sandwich or whatever. Or you could even go in fast-forward mode or something and, you know, fast-forward right to the part where the enemy shows up.
Yeah.
And you can do the same thing with flight simulators. You can enter slewing mode, right? You do the takeoff, and you get up to level, and you get all trimmed out, and you're flying straight and level, and you're like, okay, well, now it's going to take me, like, 5 hours to fly to Houston, Fort Worth Airport or whatever. And so you just enter slewing mode, and you get slew over there, and then you're like, okay, now I'm on the approach, and I'm going to come in, you know, set for approach and all that stuff, and go down and do the landing. And so you get to do all the interesting parts of the game without all the boring stuff in between.
Right, just 5 hours of sitting behind the controls.
So then you can practice things that you wouldn't want to be in real life in that situation, but you can in the simulation. You know, you've got engine failure, you know, landing gear sticks, and you got to practice a landing with no landing gear, right, things like that, where it's like you can't just practice that in an airport. You destroy airplanes that way. But you can do it in a simulation. And so then the simulationist aspects are working for you because you're like, okay, well, this is what it would really feel like. You know, all these controls would still be available to me, all this operation, you know, this is how it would behave. And so then you can get a feel for what you should do in those situations. And I feel like that's probably pretty valuable.
Yeah, you mentioned Kerbal Space Program earlier, and it lets you do that. You can just take a mulligan. You're like, oh, yeah, I wrecked. Or I had an incident, you know, during the ascent. Didn't quite make it out of the atmosphere. Kind of got flipped over, turned the wrong way, and fell apart. But, yeah, you can...
Supersonic spin.
Yeah. But you can just, you know, do a mulligan. It's like go back to launch pad or even go all the way back to the construction bay or whatever it's called. And try a new design. You know, you get 500 feet in the air and you notice the nose of your rocket is really wobbling and precarious. And you're like, all right, this is not going to work. By the time we get up to speed, this whole thing's going to fall apart. So you can just jump back in time. It would be very, very fiddly to play that game without the constant auto saves.
Yeah. Like you were saying, if it's really punishing, like you wouldn't want to play Kerbal Space Program punishing mode.
Right. At least not until you're good at it. Scott Manley can do it these days, but you know, he's mastered the game. You definitely wouldn't, the vast majority of people would not want to learn to play Kerbal Space Program in some sort of hardcore mode where you can't take back mistakes. And you just have to deal with all your crashes. That would be super sad.
Yeah. And in the same sense, I feel like Dark Souls would have a much larger audience if they had an training mode or something where you could just practice against the bosses until you understood their patterns and stuff. And then you could, you know, play the game through if you wanted to using the normal Dark Souls method of, you know, dying is costly.
I don't know if it would make the audience bigger. It would definitely make the game more appealing for me.
Yeah. Me too. I wouldn't play a game that didn't allow me to access the whole game reliably, I guess. Like, the same thing with dungeon crawl games. Like, I played Lindley's Dungeon Crawl years and years ago, and I just save-scummed it because it was, like, not because I was, like, rolling the numbers over and over again, but just because I wanted to be able to, like, experience the whole game without experiencing the first part 100 times more often than the last part.
Right, yeah, yeah. It really does. Unless that first part is really just amazing, then, yeah, after a while it wears on you, and you're just like, well, I have to either put up with not having fun, or I have to shelf the game, or I have to cheat. Those are the options.
Yeah. So, yeah, simulationist games, yeah. I would say definitely they need to have some sort of slewing mode or cheat mode or some way to, or saves at least, like quick saves, so that you can be buffered against the relentless simulationist aspects of it.
The other danger of simulating is that once you start doing a little simulation, you will be inexorably pulled to doing more and more and more. People say, you only let me carry 2 guns. You know, I can carry, okay, I can sling a rifle here, and I can carry one of my hands, and then I can have a revolver on my hip. This game is unrealistic. I should be, you know, I could put a game on, I could put a game. I could put a gun on my ankle with a little holster. All right. Well, so the game will let you simulate all these different holsters. Oh, well, you've let me have all these different holsters, but this doesn't make any sense. It's letting me put this kind of gun into this holster. That's ridiculous. It doesn't even fit. Okay, well, we'll have all these different kinds of holsters. And then it's like, well, you know, some people complain, you know, oh, look at how fast you can draw out of that holster that's on your ankle, comes out just as fast as the one you've got on your hip. That's ridiculous. That's the downside of having something on your ankle is it takes time to get to. And, right. You know, stuff like this goes on for...
And it weighs you down, right? It's like, okay, well, we're going to add encumbrance to the game. And then some guys are like, well, but I want to be less encumbered if I've got it on my backpack than the guy who's got it on his ankle, because the ankle makes it harder to run. And it's like, okay, well, fine, we'll do, you know, ankle ones encumber you more or something. Then the guy with the backpack is like, well, hey, you know, I put it on my ankle so I could spin my torso really quickly. The guy with the backpack should be able to spin slower. And so now you got to adjust the controls sensitivity for the guys with the backpack. And
yeah. And now you're trying to, like, simulate the movement of the human body with arbitrary hunks of metal fastened to it. Because everybody wants to carry 6 guns.
Right. And then, like, your melee damage has to be adjusted, because, like, if you kick the guy and you've got an ankle gun, is that damaging the enemy, or is it damaging you through the holster?
Oh, you let me draw from my left hand, the holster on my left hip? Like, I should have to draw that with my left hand. Oh, and then somebody else is like, how come accuracy isn't affected by handedness? You should have to choose if you're left or right-handed and suffer from an aim penalty if you're using the wrong hand.
So we're joking, but I totally want to play this game now.
Me too. No. Actually, it reminds me a bit of...
That's your assignment.
It reminds me a bit of Receiver. Did you ever play Receiver?
No, I kind of wanted to, though. I watched a number of Let's Plays of Receiver.
Yeah, it's a fast... I mean, it doesn't hold up. It's not... I mean, it's pretty simulationist just with the gun. But it doesn't hold up. It's not a game you're just going to play for weeks on end. It's sort of something to noodle around with for a few hours. But it is pretty amazing to, like, think about all the moving parts of a gun that other games just abstract away. Like, oh, you don't just reload. You don't just hit one button and your magic and your gun disappears out of view into hammer space and then reappears full of bullets. Your hands have to do a bunch of complicated things to, like, get the old magazine out, retrieve a magazine, put the new magazine in, chamber around. There's a lot of motions there.
Yeah. And it's so cool. And, like, sometimes the magazine jams inside the butt. And so you've got to, like, press the eject button a few times frantically while you're trying to reload.
Yeah. So, you know, I started off thinking that simulationist games were a very bad idea, but I guess they're just really, really niche. I think simulationist games can't be big budget. You know, you've got to aim for some sort. You've got to pick one thing and simulate it really well.
Clicking on dudes' heads and making them explode. That's the simulationist we need.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I feel like we've done a show.
Yeah. It's been good to be on you this week.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Hey, by the way, we have cleared the mailbag. That's it for mailbag questions. So this is your chance to get your question answered. The address is diecast@seamusyoung.com. And the email address is also in the header image over the show on the blog. So send us your questions and we might answer them. That's it. Thanks for listening. See ya. Do right now, but I'm going to not play Anthem.